Well, this evening we have really quite a mystery story. It involves itself in many elements and factors that do not lie strictly within the sphere of music. But in order to give the story somewhat basic orientation, I think we'll begin on the campus of the University of Ingolstadt, Bavaria, about the year 1770. Many things can start on college campuses, and in a time of great political and social unrest, perhaps young people starting out in life have the clearest and most immediate recognition of the kind of a world into which they're going to be forced by circumstances to live and make their ways. In any event, on this campus, there were a great many groups of young men who took world conditions seriously, who resented the limitations imposed upon their abilities by a traditional and reactionary curriculum, and like many of the young people of today, were convinced that there were better ways of thinking and better ways of doing things than were being taught to them. Already the atmosphere was tense with Reformation and Revolution, and the general discontent of masses extended even into the comparatively placid atmosphere of Bavaria. At this time, a young man was making quite a mark for himself in the Faculty of Law of the university. When only 27 years of age, he was made Dean of the Faculty of Law. Itself a peculiar and remarkable indication of his own internal abilities. This man's name was Adam Weishaupt, and on May 1st, 1776, just 2 or 3 months before the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the United States, Adam Weishaupt founded the Order of the Illuminati on the campus of the University of Ingolstadt. Now, the original form of this society has been said to involve two distinct elements: a noble concept of purpose and a total absence of plan. This would be appropriate under the condition a movement led by a very young man, fired by still younger men, his own students, whose predicament touched him very deeply. The Order of the Illuminati began with 5 persons, and began in the rooms of the Dean of Law. Fortunately, it did not remain there very long, for early in its development, Weishaupt came in contact with 2 very important men, Dr. Bode and Baron von Knega. These 2 powerful intellectuals, leaders in their own worlds, fired with the concept behind this movement through their personal weight and their personal influence, and with a result that was to be quite outstanding and unprecedented. The study of the Illuminist order in its brief history, where it only survived a very few years, tells us that while numerically its membership was never large, the quality of that membership was reminiscent of the Almanach de Gotha. Practically every important man in the progressive motion of European life, including a number of princes and rulers, were members of this fraternity. One of the earliest actions decided upon by Weishaupt was the tremendous necessity for the maintenance of complete secrecy. At that time, Ingolstadt was a nominal Jesuit college, and for many years to come, the struggle between the church and the liberals was to be heated and constant. And so the Illuminati devised an ingenious scheme. They took a map of Europe and they divided it according to a map of the ancient world, restoring in different places the names of then forgotten or least long dead empires and kingdoms. They then divided their own members, assigning to each one a classical name by which it would be almost impossible to identify them. And they wrote their own sort of private historical geography of world situations. For our present purpose, it is important to note that in their new geography, the Illuminati assigned the name Egypt to Austria. And that from that time on, in all of their official documents, references to Egypt were references to Austria. The purposes behind the motion of the Illuminati were several. First and perhaps foremost, the advancement of the right of the human being to think. That intellectual progress should be rescued from a reactionary traditional form and allowed to develop and unfold according to humanist concepts and instincts. Another important phase of their activity was the statement of their slogan or the motto of their society, namely, liberty, equality, and fraternity. And these exact words later became the cry of the French Revolution. There is much to indicate that the French Revolution was influenced by the Illuminists, or the Illuminati, who moved behind the surface picture, and whose names were associated with a number of prominent individuals and intellectuals moving in the great era of revolutions. Among the most distinguished of the Illuminists should be included Goethe, the Prince of Saxe-Weimar, the mysterious and elusive Saint Germain, the equally mysterious, though not quite so elusive, Cagliostro, and later Claude Saint Martin, and numerous other leaders in the great struggle for the rights of man. It is believed that this movement affected deeply Rousseau and Voltaire, and later in the United States, both Jefferson and Thomas Paine were accused of being members of this organization. So in a quiet but persuasive manner, the Illuminati spread beneath the surface of European thought. And its principal rituals, ceremonies, and rites were based upon the mysteries of the Greeks and Egyptians. For Weishaupt himself was a classicist, and among his desires was to restore the great philosophical systems of initiation education which dominated the ancient world. He was unable to attain this end, but he still struggled valiantly toward it, and in their brief span, the Illuminati became a most disconcerting force in European politics, largely because they were so difficult to identify, and their presence was universally suspected, whether they were there or not. The power of this organization became almost similar to that of the Ku Klux Klan in the South after the Civil War. It was feared by many, honored by some, and regarded as little short of miraculous by others. it gradually attracted to itself an elaborate symbolism derived partly from alchemy, partly from mythology, partly from Kabbalism, and all the mysterious secret societies of the 16th and 17th centuries. In the midst of all this excitement, Adam Weishaupt became a Freemason, and this was to have a bearing upon the later development, for the lodge that he joined was almost immediately absorbed into the Illuminist movement, and it was not until considerably later, when the great Masonic councils were held to clarify the degrees and rights of the order, that the Illuminists were forced to clarify their Masonic position. It was all quite an involved and difficult situation, but this is one of our roots, because we learn by careful investigation that the outstanding Illuminist in Austria was Baron Ignaz von Born, who was a metallurgist and highly honored in the court of Maria Theresa. This important man was a personal friend of Mozart, and it is believed that in the designing of the opera, The Magic Flute, von Born supplied much of the material, at least symbolically speaking, for the creation of the character of Sarastro, the great priest of the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. Mozart himself was recommended for Freemasonry by Baron von Gemmingen, a distinguished member of the order, and the lodge to which he belonged, by some circumstance, was also very closely associated with von Born. And when this great chemist perfected his method for metallic amalgamation and certain formulas for the hardening and purifying of metals, Mozart wrote a piece of music to be played in the lodge, which at that time held a festival in honor of von Born. So we find that Mozart, Goethe, the Prince of Saxe-Weimar, Knager, Bode, and later the man who was entrusted with the development of the story of the magic flute, Schikaneder, were all members of the Masonic Order. This has certain bearing upon our problem, but we will pause in this direction for a moment and go back into another interesting byway that leads in the same general direction. About 1731, there was issued a book called The Life of Sethos. Incidentally, we have a copy of the rare first English edition of this work in our library for anyone who wishes to consult it. It was published first in about 1731 and came into English about 1760 or 70 or thereabout. The Life of Sethos was another book looking for an author, which sometimes happens in the world of literature. Many suspects were advanced, but no one was ever finally decided as the guilty for the perpetration of this volume. The story claimed to have been found as a manuscript in a European library and to be a true account of a man by the name of Sethos, who lived in the classical period and who was initiated into the rites of Isis and Osiris. The third book of Sethos deals, therefore, largely with the ritual of initiation, centering upon the passing of Orpheus and Eurydice through the rites and rituals of the underworld. Various authors have commented upon the book of Sethos. It has generally been accepted as a fabrication. Who fabricated it and why? No one knows. But whoever did had a considerable familiarity with the writings of the classical authors, and his production belongs with two others, one called The Initiation of Plato, and the other the Krater Rapport, or the Rituals of Initiation into the Greek and Egyptian Mysteries, all of which came out at about the same time, and contributed to the establishment of the Egyptian rite of Freemasonry by Alessandro Cagliostro. All of these different facets also indicated that in the 18th century there was a powerful rise of interest in Egyptian philosophy. This rise was prior to the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, and nearly all of the records available were those from Roman sources, as for instance the hieroglyphics of Herapolonilas. In any event, however, there was a fanciful restoration of Egyptology, and this continued to remain more or less imaginative until, through the cooperation of Napoleon, the Rosetta Stone was made available to the students of Egyptology in Europe, and Champollion supplied the necessary key to its interpretation. So we have the Book of Sethos, probably itself originating in one of the secret societies of Europe. Written for a distinct and definite purpose, this purpose very close to its ultimate adaptation by Mozart. These elements, then, seem to tell us something of the background of what has sometimes been referred to as Mozart's comic opera. This is a bit of an exaggeration, for there is nothing really less comic than the concept or the purpose behind it. I think we also have to bear in mind just a little something about Mozart himself. We know him as a musician, we know him as a man struggling for years against poverty, we know him as a genius and an artist and then practically an infant prodigy, but perhaps what we do not know about him was his fiery patriotism. He was a man moved from within himself by exactly the type of motivation that inspired Weishaupt in the founding of the Illuminist movement. It has never been possible to prove by documentation that Mozart belonged to this order, but certainly his sympathies were strongly with it. He was a patriot. He was fighting desperately, as maybe later we find in the case in Hungary of Petőfi Sándor, also a poet, also a mystic, fighting desperately for the freedom of the Magyars. This great struggle for mental or intellectual emancipation in Europe influenced Mozart's career to a large degree to its economic detriment. His very dislike for patronage, as it had been previously doled out, his resistance to merely becoming a pawn, a musical pawn, in the court of Austria, contributed to his impoverishment, probably his discouragement, and early death. But we know Mozart was a person of great humanitarian convictions, and perhaps in the story of the Magic Flute, he has summarized or brought together the choicest of his reflections, and with the assistance of those who cooperated to make the project possible, he was able to fit together a very convincing and very wonderful allegory. It is also noted in the libretto of the Magic Flute that while mysteries, symbols, and even occasional Masonic emblems appear and are used, there is not one single line of the opera that can be considered in any way an expose of Masonry. Evidently, Mozart, being himself under the obligations of the craft, was exceedingly careful and conscientious in producing a fantasy that was essentially Masonic and yet without any direct bearing which might be regarded as an expose of Masonry. Now, the interpreters of the story have a variety of possible selections upon which to base the purpose of the opera itself. Perhaps it would be well, therefore, to point out that at that time, Masonic lodges in Austria were having a rather bad period. Maria Theresa was violently opposed to the order. For her son Joseph II was himself a Mason. And this brought the controversy directly into the royal household. Maria Theresa is known on one occasion to have visited a Masonic lodge and attempted to break it up by introducing troops, soldiers, detectives, and other personnel from the state. At that particular time, her own son was in lodge with the brethren and had to depart hastily through a back window. All of this might indicate that situations were a bit tense at that time. In fact, after the comparatively liberal reign of Joseph, the Austrian Masonry may be said to have almost completely vanished. And for nearly a century, there was no Masonic activities under the black eagle of the Habsburgs. So the situation of Masonry was precarious, and Masonry at that time was being tied very closely to the revolutionary spirit rising in Europe and associated very closely with the determination to improve educational opportunities for the people and to advance democracy and what Paine and Rousseau so aptly refer to as the rights of man. This situation is more or less involved in Mozart's personal life and considerably involved in the story of the Magic Flute. We know that this also was not Mozart's only Masonic contributions. He prepared short pieces of music based even upon the themes of Masonic ritual. These were played by the lodge, and the lodge to which he belonged paid his widow a small amount of money for the rights to his Masonic music after his death. This small amount of money, relatively nothing, constituted the major part of his estate. For even to this day, the grave of Mozart is unknown because he was buried in Potter's Field. The mourners were so few that even the spot remained unidentified, and his wife was traveling in a distant region at the time. So Mozart, as far as his own physical life is concerned, lived a very difficult and sorrow-laden existence. But there was a tremendous spirit within the man, which was revealed not only through his music, but through his humanitarian instincts and ideals. So now perhaps we have laid some foundation for a more careful examination of the story itself. The story of the Magic Flute is a comparatively simple one, but it has a number of interesting minor involvements. In the first place, it deals with a romantic fairy tale situation, derived in part from the mythology of the ancients, especially the abduction of Proserpine by Hades, which of course ties it directly to the Eleusinian mysteries of the Greeks. In this story, as it is presented in the opera, a handsome young man, the eternal hero of the world, Prince Tamino, wanders mysteriously and strangely into the domains of the Queen of the Night. Now, the Queen of the Night rules over a fanciful world. And in this world, which is much of the world of Grimm and Andersen, many strange and miraculous things can happen. And while Prince Tamino is wandering in this region, he is attacked by a great serpent. This great serpent pursues him, and as the young prince is unarmed, he finds grave difficulty in escaping and gives up all hope that his life will be spared when three mysterious maidens called genii appear, armed with spears with silver points. These slay the serpent, even while the prince himself lies unconscious from exhaustion on the ground. When he awakens from his exhaustion and from the abject fear into which the experience has precipitated him, the young prince looks up to find himself confronted by a most extraordinary creature. this creature gives the rough impression of being human. But actually, the parts of his body are covered with bird feathers. And he jumps around and makes strange sounds and noises and seems quite the clown and quite the eccentric. He is Papageno, a mysterious being who is more or less of a fool and a buffoon. Papageno is always boastful, however, and under a little pressure admits that he is the one who slew the snake and saved the young prince. About this time, the three genii, or maidens with their silver-tipped spears, appear, tell the truth, and punish Papageno by placing upon his lips a padlock so that he may not speak from that time on, so that for sometime he wanders about grunting and puffing against the padlock, but unable to make any particularly articulate sounds. The three maidens, or the three genii, then tell the young prince Tamino that they belong to the suite of the Queen of the Night, that she knows that he has wandered into her region, and that she desires to speak to him and know him because she has a very definite and particular errand which she would like to have him perform. In due course, the young prince discovers what this errand is. It seems that the daughter of the Queen of the Night has been strangely and mysteriously abducted by a mysterious person named Sarastro, who was Grand Master of the Mysteries of Isis and Osiris. Now, of course, the Queen of the Night wishes her daughter, Tamina, to be restored to her. And so she supplies the young prince with certain things necessary to accomplish the rescuing of this fair maiden. Among other things, because he does not know the region, nor is he capable of coping with the enchantments of Sarastro, she gives him a magic flute with seven openings on which strange and wonderful melodies can be played. And she also gives him a jewel-encrusted framed portrait of her daughter so that he may recognize the princess when he sees her. As a somewhat less useful aid, or what you may term associate, the young prince also inherits Papageno, who promises to complicate almost any situation. Papageno, of course, also needs something to help him to take care of the difficulties of his assignment, so he is given an instrument called a branch of bells, which in actuality is a form of the old Egyptian sistrum, or rattle, that was used in connection with the ceremonies of the Temple of Isis. The group then start out on their journey, and with due and proper adventures, attempt the rescue of the fair princess, who is being held in bondage, presumably, by Sarastro. They come finally to his palace, which is presented in the opera as an Egyptian-like building or temple, and here priests and other dignitaries bearing Masonic symbols and chanting ancient rituals form an appropriate background. Now, we are also introduced at this time to another interesting and rather curious character, who is a sort of jailkeeper or general overseer in the court of Sarastro. And this is Monostatus the Moor, a strange, dark man who would like to be a villain but is not very successful at it. As a villain, he is in love with the fair princess, but she not only spurns his advances, but Sarastro, ever watchful, makes certain that all his conspiracies come to nothing. So that the Moor plays the part of a very frustrated individual who is unable to succeed in almost any of his undertakings. Of course, the meeting of Tamina and Tamino results in the rise of romance, and Sarastro guards this situation also with great thoughtfulness. In the due time, the queen of the night, who is not at all pleased with the direction that events are taking, also enters into the palace of Sarastro, forcibly, perhaps reminiscent of Maria Theresa trying to break up the Masonic meeting in Vienna, and gives her daughter a dagger, suggesting that it would be wise for her to slay Sarastro. At this time, however, the young prince becomes under an obligation of secrecy in connection with the rituals of the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. While under secrecy, he is misunderstood by Pamina, who, thinking that he no longer cares for her, attempts to kill herself. The plot becomes more and more complicated at this time, but in their attempt to leave the palace or to leave the shrine of initiation, the two young people come under the direct influence of Sarastro, who prepares them and for them the elaborate ceremonial of initiation into the rites of Isis and Osiris. While wandering about also in the mysterious underworld, Papageno has quite a little experience of his own. He has only one great desire in life, and that is to find himself a feathered mate of mentality and nature similar to his own. Because he is quite an eccentric, it looks very doubtful if he'll ever succeed. But in this underground and subterranean region of mysteries, he is confronted with an ancient witch, or hag, who is about as little what he demands as anything could possibly be. She is a horrible creature, but with considerable force of character, she points out that unless he will consent to marry her, he will never leave the underworld alive. This is a very doubtful situation, and leaves poor Papageno, who is no hero at any time, with very little choice. In due course, however, it proves that this strange witch-like person is really a good spirit in disguise, because suddenly the old hag is transformed into the feathered mate that Papageno has been seeking all of time, and they, of course, have a joyous union, and all goes well with them. In the meantime, the rituals of Isis and Osiris are arranged, and the two young lovers pass through the strange ceremonies of the underworld. The stage for this is very beautifully set, and when the curtain rises, the tests of the elements are revealed. The stage is so divided that it has three doorways, one in the center and one on each side. The side doors are grated, covered with bars, and behind the one on one side is seen flames rising and smoke and combustion, whereas on the other side, behind the door, is seen streams of water, like a great waterfall flowing from an unknown source. Between these doors and the central entrance are high columns surmounted by figures in armor. It is a very impressive scene. Pamino and Tamina, young lovers, are able to pass through the initiations because he plays constantly upon the flute, and because of the music of the flute, no ill can come to him. Having therefore passed successfully through the flames and through the tests of water, the young lovers pass through the central door. The scene changes, and they are in the great chapel temple of the mysteries. Here, presided over by Sarastro in his flowing robes, bearing a scepter, surmounted by an effulgent and radiant sun globe, and surrounded by his priests, musicians, and retinue. The great master or hierophant blesses the young couple, unites them in spiritual union, and assures them that they have passed successfully through this great test which was prepared for them. Everything ends in a note of heroic victory and in a musical situation which suggests great elevation and spiritual accomplishment and consciousness. This is, in very brief, the story of the opera. And it is upon this foundation that the various critics have attempted to explain it, interpret it, and discover its inner meaning. At least five different systems have been applied to the interpretation of the magic flute. These cover almost every phase of contemporary life and philosophical abstraction. First of all, it has been assumed, for example, that the Queen of the Night represented definitely Maria Theresa. This concept is extended also into other phases. The young prince, Tamino, is believed to be Joseph II, who was in favor of and a protector of Masonry in Austria. By this same concept, Tamina is the Austrian people whose salvation and redemption the young prince is determined to advance. Sarastro is a combination of masonry, science, knowledge, education, and reason, representing practically all of the forces of the new humanism and the spirit of progress and liberation, which is to initiate the people of Austria into psychological and even literal democratic living and thinking. In this same concept, the black Moor, Monostatus, becomes the symbol of the Jesuits, which at that time were regarded as particularly difficult because a certain man under their influence by the name of Hoffman was responsible for scandals against masonry which caused the closing of the Austrian lodges. Therefore, he is believed to have been personified in this drama or in this concept. Thus, the drama would be very largely an unfoldment of the political life of the time. But it is quite improbable that such exhausted Mozart's original intention, because he certainly used a favorable situation, because in many respects, the more the interpretations, the more numerous the viewpoints, the more certain the real meaning could be concealed, because it was always possible to blame it to this or blame it to that, and keep it away from those who might otherwise be moved to act against it in a powerful and organized manner. As a fantasy, it could be produced and presented, where if the same remarks had been made in a severe literary style, the author would probably have been subjected to extreme punishment, imprisonment, or exile. Now, when we go into this question a little further, then, we realize that the entire drama derived in part, at least, from the life of Sethos, does go back to a certain degree into the rituals of the old mysteries, where much more than contemporary politics would be considered. We recognize under the veil, therefore, of the Queen of the Night, the ancient goddess Kori, or Ceres, who was the strange and peculiar patroness of the harvest and of the rituals of food and plenty and the home, and to a great degree the entire normal or moral life of mankind. It was the daughter of Kori, Proserpine, who was abducted by Hades or Pluto and taken into the underworld. The abduction, therefore, could well parallel the abduction of Pamina, who was taken away by Sarastro, a strange person living in a darkened sphere or palace with subterranean abodes and mysterious places beneath it. This deity, of course, is also as closely associated with Osiris, who after his martyrdom became Lord of the Underworld. And the rituals of the Osirian rites were nearly always practiced in subterranean caves or crypts or rooms under the temples. So here we have two phases of the god of the underworld abducting the fair daughter of the goddess of the night. Under the same situation, Monostatus plays very close to the Egyptian concept of Typhon, the betrayer, the false one, who was also referred to as dark, and who was believed to have been a form of the prince of evil. These characters being variously distinguished, it becomes evident then that the young prince always represents the person, the initiate, the hero, the one to whom these adventures must naturally occur, and through whose regeneration and whose enlightenment represents, of course, the liberation of man himself. So we can have a new group of elements involved in this, which can go even as far as Asia, if we wish to, in search of a deeper and more mystical and metaphysical meaning for our story. In this same classification, Papageno comes in also as a form of the old deity Pan, the god of nature. And of course, the sistrum symbolizing the agitations of nature, as Plutarch says, could associate with him as well as with Isis, whose part also seemingly mingles with that of the queen of the night. So we have quite a complicated situation, which calls perhaps for an interpretation on a level of Greek metaphysical philosophy. This is perfectly reasonable, inasmuch as it was dominating the Illuminists of the time, particularly von Born, who was brought in consultation on the development of the opera, and quite possibly was very close to the soul of Mozart himself. When on one occasion Goethe was told that the magic flute was little better than a fantasy, he replied quietly, "It may seem so to the average spectator, but not to those of us who are initiated." And he seemed to be very clear in his statement of this point. So now we have an interesting concept to build upon. The Egyptians divided the universe into three essential parts. One was a universe of spirit, or of eternal life, the abode of the gods. One was a sphere of matter, which, as in the case of the Platonic philosophy in Greece, was called the underworld. And between these two was the abode of heroes, or of those who had liberated themselves from darkness, or who had been born again through the rites of the mysteries. In Egypt, as in many other ancient custom countries, we find that Isis, as the mother of mysteries, as the great Diana, goddess of the Ephesians, the Multimamia, the universal mother, that this deity always represents the mystery school itself. She is the widow whose sons become the liberators and the golden hawks of light who are to save the world. Therefore, the initiate was always referred to as the son of the widow, because Isis, wearing the weeds of a widow and with ashes upon her head, wandered about the earth, mourning the loss of her lord, the god Osiris. The mysteries, then, were nocturnal and subterranean, and consisted principally of an account of the wandering of the human soul in the underworld during the state of mortality or ignorance. Plutarch, in his Cave of the Nymphs, gives us another example of this drama, and part of the setting would almost agree with the great initiation scene in the Magic Flute. According to Plutarch, the Cave of the Nymphs, who might well be the three genii who appeared to the young prince, has two openings, one of which is the entrance and the other is the exit. From this entrance, steps lead downward into a crypt, and opposing upon the opposite side, steps ascend to an exit. And the gate of entrance is called Cancer, and the gate of exit is called Capricorn. And the dome of the cave is covered with stars, but the bottom of it is rough and rocky, and it is filled with strange shadows and wonderful and lamenting music is heard, and strange spirits move about, and those who enter into this underworld are attacked by shadows, by mysterious monsters against whom they must contend for victory. The same situation was set up in the catacombs under Rome in the celebration of the ancient Mithraic mysteries. And when the Emperor Commodus was initiated into the Mithraic rites, he was attacked by phantoms and defended himself so vigorously that he killed one of the priests accidentally, who was disguised as a phantom. The dramatic ritual seemingly affected the emperor a little too strenuously. As the ritual of this situation proceeds, we see that through the gate of birth, man descends into a dark world, ruled over by mysteries, ruled over by mortality and death. And in this world, which is also the world of Pan, the world which we referred to in our last discussion, in which Mephisto plays the part of the deity Pan. In the magic flute, Pan is a more or less helpless creature, a mountebank, but does still represent the accidents and vicissitudes of nature and of the rustic or natural situation of primitive mankind. In the ritual of initiation, therefore, man born at the gate of Cancer is immediately presented with the cup of Lethe, which is a small constellation near to Cancer, which is called the constellation of the Crator, or cup. In this constellation, and in the symbol thereof, man born into matter goes to sleep or loses all memory, for the cup of Lethe is the cup of forgetfulness. He thereby forgets his heavenly origin, forgets the world from which he came, and finds himself strangely immersed in the mysterious regions ruled over by the Queen of the Night. And the Queen of the Night is the moon, and later the Queen of the Night is Isis. But to man coming into the world at the beginning, this material world is not a place of initiation or a place of regeneration. It is a place of terrors and fears, ruled over by the tyranny of darkness and ignorance. Therefore, the Queen of the Night may be both Maria Theresa, as a symbol of the absolute sovereignty and tyranny of matter, or Isis, as the ever-prudent and ever-guiding mother, the nurse, the Hathor, the cow-headed one of Egypt, who leads souls finally into the realization that the experiences of mortality are for the regeneration of man and not merely for his destruction. In any event, the wandering through the underworld carries man into the presence of the serpent and the danger of death. The serpent appears in the Sigurd saga, where young Siegfried or Sigurd must slay it. And the slaying of the dragon or the serpent, as found in the myth of St. George of Cappadocia, also comes into this picture. The serpent is the ancient symbol of illusion. And the struggle between man, his mind, his being, his life, and illusion is a very important one. Even in the time of the rise of the French mysteries, during the period of Cagliostro and Saint Germain, it was pointed out that man possesses within himself a mysterious agency which is called the astral light. The astral light is the substance from which the magic garden of Klingsor was composed in the opera of Parsifal. And the 19th century French transcendentalist Eliphas Levy refers to the astral light as a mysterious world of beauty and flowers, beautiful blossoms, radiant and inspiring, and around the stem of each flower twisted a poisonous serpent. It's quite a dramatic symbolic picture. But the world of the astral light is simply the sphere of human imagination, uncontrolled and undirected by reason. It is man subject constantly to the delusions of his own emotions and thinking. So man, seeking to control, master, or even survive in the darkness of the underworld, must slay the serpent of imagination, or in this case, the serpent of fantasy. This is actually excellent Buddhism, because it is told to us in the teachings of the Diamond Sutra, for example, that because of the phenomenal existence engendered by the sensory function of man, the human being lives in a world that has no existence except that which he bestows upon it. The human being who could move serenely like the candidate for the mysteries through this dark region and come safely to the gate of Capricorn, which leads through the mystery of death to the mystery of immortality. This human being, instead of living a dignified and noble existence in the underworld and its mysterious passageways, is actually tormented constantly by fantasy and hallucination. Fantasy, in this case, meaning all false or unreasonable ends or ideas which dominate him. The fantasy of ambition, the fantasy of pride, of selfishness, of greed, the fantasy of passion and appetite, the fantasy of success or failure, all of the innumerable forces which deprive man of his natural nobility may be inferred. We perhaps know a little better about this fantasy element than was generally known 100 or 200 years ago, because it is coming strongly to us in our studies of psychology. We know that the delusions, frustrations, neuroses, complexes, and psychoses which affect man are nothing but delusions arising within himself. His own false estimations of value, his own misunderstandings, his own natural instincts to be selfish, to create doubt and uncertainty, and his criticism, his jealousy, all of these things turning upon him like monsters, destroy his peace of mind and prevent him thereby from fulfilling the natural destiny for which he is intended. The three genii, like the three fates or the three norms, represent the dimensions of time. They also represent the intuitive powers by means of which man is able to be protected from these evils. In one system of interpretation, they are likened to the three graces, faith, hope, and charity, through the practice of which the dragon or demon is discomfited and the serpent is killed with the silver-tipped spears. Also in this lower world, man discovers another kind of creature, Papageno. This creature has never lived anywhere else and represents the natural and rustic nature of primitive man. Here the truth seeker discovers, for example, that the world around him is filled with people who do not particularly wish to know anything, not interested in seeking truth, but interested only in finding a mate like themselves and settling down and living out their lives. They have no ambitions of any importance, no aspirations. They do not know how to tell the truth, and in order to control them at all, a padlock must be placed upon their lips. They represent a primitive type of materiality, which also is to be found lurking in this subterranean world. And this materiality divides itself in the nature of man. For as Goethe says in his Faust, there are two souls within man. One to the heaven aspires, and the other in the earth suspires. And many people, many interpreters, have held that Papageno represents the lower octave of the hero himself, representing compromise, comfort, and all these things which would lure the individual away from great and noble purpose. Another interpretation, of course, is that Papageno simply represents the physical body, which never knows what anything is about, babbles constantly, and is constantly pressing forward for the fulfillment of its physical creature comforts and its biological urges. This body cannot and must not be acknowledged as a leader. And yet, in some mysterious way, it must be present, because without the fool, the hero cannot undertake his journey. And the body thereby becomes this nominal hindrance, this capering feathered thing, which contributes very little, but does make an occasional, fairly valid contribution to the general situation. If we consider, therefore, that Papageno represents simply matter, either in the physical life of man, in the materialism of the human mind, or in the rustic materialism of human society, we probably will not be too far from the facts of the matter. The body, seeking only peace, comfort, and security, is not heroic, but may be forced to an occasional exhibition of heroism by the hero self that lives within it. Thus, the young prince, wandering around in search of his mission, is presented with the next important concept, which we find in metaphysics. Isis, Cori, Ceres, the great Diana of the Ephesians, and many other of these deities actually embody or personify or represent in the mystery systems the world soul, or the great psychic nature, which lies in the root substance or archetypal measure of things. According to the Greek mythology, the great gods, the spiritual beings, the unmoved movers of all things, cause to emanate from themselves that which is called the self-moving. And the self-moving is the psychic field, or the median distance in man's nature, which we call today the soul. The soul in nature, according to Pythagoras, is its animating part. Therefore, it is the anima, or the psychic energy sphere, from which all of man's sensory and even his intuitive faculties are supported and sustained. Modern psychology would define the soul principally as mind and emotion. The ancients, however, would have had a slightly different concept. They did not consider the mind as part of the soul, essentially. They considered the intellectual principle as a separate spiritual element in nature. But they did count that part of man which is essentially religious, the emotion of devotion, of love, of piety. These things pertain to the soul, which Pythagoras represented by an eight-faced symmetrical solid, because he said that the soul had eight attributes, of which the lowest, or eighth, was the attribute of generation. If, therefore, the world soul, the psychic field which is the soul of deity, would be regarded as Isis or as the queen of the night, then the human soul would be her daughter, apart from this universal soul.